Earplay is made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. A series of contemporary plays for radio. Earplay.
This week, Earplay presents American Modern by the Canadian playwright Joanna M. Glass. Her best-known play, Artichoke, has been produced by the Tarragon Theatre in Toronto, the Long Wharf in New Haven, and the Cricket Theatre in Minneapolis. In addition, Miss Glass has written a novel, Reflections on a Mountain Summer, and was commissioned by the Canadian Arts Council to write a full-length play. American Modern by Joanna M. Glass.
Long?
Oh, half an hour.
Hungry?
Whenever you are.
Sad?
Whenever you are. What you got?
Interesting. Very interesting. I just couldn't resist it. I got off the bus, and I was really going to try and make it home empty-handed. I mean, it's only two blocks. But look, I found it all in this order. Look at this.
A stone?
A stone with an initial scratched on it. Scratched on, I think, with another stone. And then...
A feather?
A quill. A stone, a quill, and then... A stubby pencil, a beat-up old Parker, a Bic ballpoint pen. I found them all in that order. And then, when I reached our block, guess who I saw watering his lawn? Mr. Gutenberg.
Oh, too much. Remarkable progression. Right. To summarize, man will express himself.
To summarize, woman will make order out of nonsense.
Did you see him?
Yes.
Well, tell us about it. How did it go?
Hell, I don't know. He said it would take a long time. I said that was fine with me. I've got a lifetime. But what, I wondered, would take a long time? I said, you mean mental health takes a long time? I'm afraid he hedged. He said he couldn't guarantee a resolution.
Well, I guess we knew that.
The goal seems to be a better understanding. I told him that was the problem. I told him that we understood and have for years. We understand, I said, and what we need is a resolution. He said... Resolutions couldn't be bought. Well, I thought that was rather unrealistic of him, but I didn't say so. Oh, I saw a fantastic thing on my way to his office. Can I tell you?
Sure.
I was walking past the plaza toward 6th Avenue. A beautiful woman came out and stood on the steps, saying goodbye to a handsome man. She was a tall, really elegant woman, around 30. Expensively, but quietly dressed. She and the man seemed very sad. I thought they were going to cry. There was so much sorrow in their parting. I didn't know if they just had lunch or if they'd gone to bed or what, but there was something illicit about it all. And I knew that whatever was between them was doomed. I thought, if they lingered there a moment longer, I'd scream, or go berserk, or make a terrible, embarrassing scene. Then a chauffeur-driven Cadillac pulled up. She touched him, one last time and got in. He turned and went back into the hotel. I walked quickly alongside the Cadillac for half a block because I wanted to see what she was doing, feeling, what posture she would take. Jesus, do you know what she did?
What?
She put her fingers into her mouth and took out a partial plate.
Really?
And then she sucked on one side of it as if a piece of food was stuck there.
Oh, Christ.
Then she saw me running alongside the car. She popped the plate back into her mouth and ordered the chauffeur to drive faster.
Oh, that's incredible. What did you make of it?
I don't know. I guess they just had lunch.
Did you tell him that when you got there?
No. I didn't think it pertained to anything. I tried to keep pertinence uppermost in my mind.
Yeah, it was a smart choice at 50 an hour. Did he agree with your ideas of pertinence?
No, he wanted to tunnel. At one point, I said, listen, these picayune little things just aren't pertinent. He said he must hear them if he was to probe the darker reaches of my soul.
Hmm?
Well, that surprised me. I said, you mean my mind? No, he said, your soul.
Any evidence of religious affiliation around the room?
None. There was a pair of copper-coated baby shoes on one of his files.
That's disconcerting.
Not really. They sort of lent an air of stability to the whole thing. He had a list by his telephone on his desk.
Of what?
I had to read it upside down, surreptitiously. 4 Minute Maid orange juice, 1 Sara Lee cheesecake, box SOS, well, all of which isn't very interesting. But down at the bottom, it said, 2 free coffee mugs at the Shell station.
You're kidding.
No.
Made in Hong Kong.
Yes. Oh, God. We're hopeless snobs.
The saving grace being, we understand we are.
I got down to brass tacks as soon as I could. I said, some days I'm a rat. Some days I'm a squirrel. Some days I'm a magpie.
Blurted it out, just like that, huh?
Just like that.
Imagine listening to stuff like that day after day.
Hour after hour. I don't envy him his job.
The least understandable profession, though, is gynecology.
God, yes.
Sitting on a little stool, some sort of poking apparatus in one hand, a flashlight in the other, searching for tumors and cysts.
One of the narrower pursuits, you might say. I said, look, as simply as I can put it, I salvage things. Well, he said, there's hope in that.
Aha, he said. Now, here is a juicy little aberration. Salvation, he said, in your salvaging. There's hope for a person who saves. Jesus saves. A penny saved is a penny earned. Waste not, want not. Did he have a sense of humor?
No.
Well, did you feel any rapport at all?
Well, he had a globe in the office. Somehow we got on the subject of travel. We've both been to the same places. Seems we missed each other at Stonehenge by only one day.
Coincidence? Did you discuss it?
We talked a bit about Merlin and the Druids.
Did you tell him categorically there is no Camelot?
I think he knew. It is, after all, his business to know.
What's in the box?
An hourglass. The gift he gave me.
Ah, a bonus for opening an account.
I will come to that in sequence. He asked me what I save. He said, these things you salvage, what are they?
Did you tell him?
Not readily.
Well, did he pry? Was he overbearing?
He asked if it could be recycled. I said, no, none of it. He said, surely something of value. I said, no, nothing of value. I said, haven't you ever seen us? We walk stooped over in the gutters with heavy shopping bags. Our eyes dart here and there, catching glimpses of shreds, specks, shiny particles. We cull and winnow and bring home bits of tangled yarn and dead anemones. Certainly nothing of value. I told him simply, in my case, I fill the empty spaces. For instance, in my nursery, I have gathered punctured condoms, teething rings, rectal thermometers, Q-tips, and cotton balls. In my library, I have scraps of tattered paper. Some of it is scorched. My only criterion is that the print must be legible. I have all manner of labels, menus, napkins, business cards, fragmentary headlines, theater bills, multicolored ticket stubs. And in a special album, I have salutations and postscripts from letters. I treasure the ones that begin, Dear John, and the ones that end, Be sure and give me a jingle whenever you're in town.
He must have wondered how it all began.
He did. And I prepared for that. I was going to be calm and logical and, above all, original. You would have been disappointed in me.
You blew it?
I became undone. I told a foolish incident. Jesus, I didn't even get them in sequence. I mean, I may be crazy, but I've always been articulate. I think I even told him about Cindy Lou. And of course I cried.
Oh, well. Listen, did you get through Times Square okay?
It's always a harrowing experience. I changed subways and tried not to notice.
There are two new ones.
Tell me.
No.
No, really, I like to hear about them when I'm safe at home.
Well, there's this guy who wears a red silk turban. He comes up and whispers in your ear, If you eat the flesh of the hog, you will die. And then he sticks something in your hand. Really quite startling, feeling this thing in your hand. Then you realize it's only a carrot.
What a relief that it's only a carrot.
Yes, indeed. Then there's a little old lady with forget-me-nots all over her hat. She comes up and whispers, If you show me, I'll show you.
Really? She probably wouldn't whisper that to me. I mean, what I'd show her, she already has.
No, she hasn't. She's a transvestite. It's really very sad. When she's not wanting a look, she runs around the platform defacing the advertisements with a magic marker. She draws enormous breasts and all the Marlboro men.
She should see a doctor.
Yes. Where did you begin?
I told him that it wasn't gradual. There were no telltale signs. The garbage didn't overflow. There was no gathering mold or mildew. The beds were made and mitered at the corners. The rubber plant was fed and flourishing.
Not only logical, but true.
Everything was orderly and intact. I washed the children's clothes at 9 each day. I put softener in the rinse cycle. I sewed on errant buttons. I ironed patches on frayed knees. I felt all the cans on the supermarket shelf and never bought a dented one. I made a chart of the fuse box and became adept at replacing blown ones. I studied the yellow pages and let my fingers do the walking. I went to community meetings and learned to amend and table motions. I drove old people to the clinic once a week and taught remedial reading to underachievers. I gave our obsolete clothing to Goodwill and collected on my block for the March of Dimes. I saved newspapers for Troop 620 and bought their cookies every spring. At regular intervals, Time and the New Yorker arrived, the National Geographic. I tried to keep abreast of the news and wrote letters to the editor. I supported the NAACP, Ralph Nader, and all of the ecologists. Schools for the Blind sent me ties they'd made. The Indian boys in Arizona sent me hand-tooled bookmarks. The house improvers cleaned my gutters and repaired my eaves. The house protectors installed alarms and laser beams. I made beautiful, lumpless gravy, smooth as silk. I filled watermelons with cantaloupe balls and made roses out of radishes. I bought a map of a cow so I could learn the good and bad in different cuts of meat. Spring for me was ironstone vases of lilac and forsythia. Summer was molded jellied salads and deviled eggs. Fall was Indian corn on the door and baked butternut squash. Winter was hot chocolate, mulled wine, coke and fruitcake for old Saint Nick. I went to bed at night, so tired, so spent, that I shook uncontrollably. And then one morning, I decided not to get up. The sun arose at 6:25 a.m. that day. The alarm went off at 7. The calendar in our clock radio had flipped its digits. I burrowed down under the covers and stayed there for a month. I lay there, huddled in the fetal position, for a month. A drumlin on the horizon of my bed. When I arose, the children were gone. And I was sometimes a rat, sometimes a squirrel, sometimes a magpie.
You want some wine?
Yeah.
The trouble is, it all sounds kind of nice.
That's the trouble. Next on the agenda was a little neurology exercise. What do you know about neurology exercises?
Neurology?
Nerves, coordination, memory, reflex.
Have to pat your head and rub circles on your stomach at the same time?
I should be so lucky. The first question was, do you remember the years of the assassinations? I asked which ones. He said the Kennedy brothers. I remembered and told him. I also told him Malcolm in 65 and Martin in 68. The second question was, do you remember the cities in which the assassinations occurred?
Oh, wait a minute. Now, don't tell me. Dallas, of course, mm-hmm. the book depository. L.A., the Ambassador Kitchen. Mm-hmm. Malcolm was in New York, I know, right. And Martin was...
Don't tell me.
Right, the sanitation strike, Memphis.
Good, very good.
Now, the assassins were Oswald...
He didn't ask me that. He asked me to count backwards from 100.
Well, that's easy enough.
By sevens?
Oh, that's dirty pool. 93, 86, 79...
It gets dirtier. His office is on the 38th floor of a building I'd never been in before. The door was closed, and there were heavy draperies on the windows. Which way is west, he says. What would you have done?
I'd have said, excuse me, I have to make wee-wee and find me a window.
He wouldn't let me. So I figured nothing ventured, nothing gained. I pointed and said, there? He said no and went into the next question.
Which was?
I didn't hear it. I just couldn't get my bearings after that.
I wonder what kind of a grading system he uses.
I think the best I can expect is a B for borderline. That was the end of the little neurology exercise.
Oh, hey, I forgot to tell you. An admirer of yours called just after I got home.
Who?
I don't know. I saw him shuffling up the walk with a battered suitcase. Looked like some old rag picker.
Oh,
I'm sorry, honey, but Jesus, you got to be more careful with these guys. I mean, his hair was all matted. His toes were hanging out of his shoes. He smelled like a distillery. He had a big red bulbous nose. No hello, no nothing. Where's the missus, he says. And I said, well, matter of fact, she's in the city. And he says, I'm,
Kenneth.
Kenneth, yeah. He says... The missus always buys a whisk broom from me when I'm down on my luck. And I said, oh, are you down on your luck now? Yes, he said. I've been in the hospital again.
Oh, no.
He says, I have to be careful. I haven't got a license. Your missus understands. And I said, well, come around tomorrow. No, he says, tomorrow's too late. It has to be now. So I said, okay, I'll take a whisk broom. No, he says, it has to be your missus. And I said, well, look, one way or another, we don't need another whisk broom. Well, he looked absolutely wounded. He said, I know that. I think he actually wiped away a tear. Oh. He said, your missus is a lot nicer than you are. And he turned on his rundown heels and he went down the walk. The question is, what's Kenneth to you?
A kindred spirit. He used to be a CPA years ago.
What are you to Kenneth?
A listening post. And a jug of wine.
Okay. Just so's I know.
He asked some obvious questions, which I chose to ignore. He asked if I'm preoccupied with snakes or lengths of garden hose. He asked me to describe my daddy. He asked, have I ever come upon the primal scene in the middle of the night? I said, please, may I take the Fifth Amendment on those? I mean, even in that situation, a person must have some rights. Then he asked who I think of. He said, of whom do you think when you make love? He suggested Burt Reynolds, Robert Redford, the Jackson Five. I tried to make him laugh. I said, At the climax, I imagine the Jolly Green Giant.
Yay! Did he laugh?
No, he got very defensive. But we both had been to Venice, so we discussed the Doge's Palace and the Bridge of Sighs. He told me Hemingway used to stay at the Greedy. I told him I'd read that in a guidebook. I said, foolishly, we once believed in second honeymoons.
You brought back pieces of the Colosseum.
And put them in a Chinese lacquered box with matchbooks from our youth.
From Romanoffs and Ciro's. We were very much in love then, weren't we?
Weren't we? Well, Benny asked if I'd given any thought to continuing my education. I said, Lord, no, I'm well out of that. What was your major, he said. I told him, child psychology. Well, he said, perhaps you'd enjoy some sort of job where you were exposed to other people. You don't seem to fraternize much. For good reason, I said. God knows I'm well out of that. Isn't there something, he said, that you've always secretly wanted to do?
I'll bet you didn't tell him.
I did. I said, I've harbored only one desire all my life.
His ears perked up.
All my life, I've wanted to tap dance on a big sound stage at MGM with a clock around my ankle to time the taps.
Like Ann Miller.
And that was when he asked me to talk of my dreams.
Ah, a rich vein to mine in your case.
Yes. I told him you had wet dreams.
Hmm?
He asked if we did it three times a week in accordance with accepted standards. I said, no, only when the moon is full. He said, aha, and hummed 8 bars of Clair de Lune.
Is he attractive?
No, unattractive. But well-traveled, so we could talk. I told him I have trouble sleeping. I sleep, I dream. Neither one knits up the raveled sleeve of care.
Well, did he suggest you buy a potter's wheel and a kiln or some needlework or try organic gardening?
No, he had a one-track mind. He asked me to describe my dream.
The desert dream.
Yes. I really didn't want to. It's so banal. Then I figured, what the hell? He's got the degree. Let him be the judge. And I told him.
You described your desert and you said, healer, listen. In my desert, there are no oases. Dromedaries do not roam. No Aladdin comforts me. There is no sheik of Araby. Salome does not dance in my desert. My desert has no song. It's arid, barren, empty. There's nothing of value. Indeed, in my desert, there is not even any sand.
There is no wind in my desert. No atmosphere at all. I'm weightless there. I float. There are no rooms to save things in. When first I dreamed, I searched and dug. I scrounged and gleaned, but nothing could be found to prove that I exist. No rubber bands, erasers, paper clips, or string. No bottle caps or safety pins, no hooks or eyes, nothing. I looked for a gutter to find something in. I looked for a gutter to hide in. I looked for a gutter to end it all in. But when I discovered there was not even any sand in my desert, I awoke, shivering, and was glad to be alive.
And, of course, he found hope in that gladness.
A shaft of light. He suggested a purge. He said the answer might be to hire a maid, an objective maid, to clean out the clutter. Empty my shelves, exorcise my demons, so that I could begin with a clean slate. I said, there's no clean slate at 40. They're only repair jobs. I said, women have energy, you know. And when our energy has no aim or goal, it doesn't diminish. It finds a home. Some of us forage. Many of us rummage. For milk glass, sandwich glass, baccarat. In the East, we hunt remnants of the China trade. In the West, Danish teak is more likely. I said, I know a girl who was an avid collector of autographs in her youth. Now she collects signatures on dress labels. The dresses don't really matter. I said, make no mistake. To empty our shelves and our closets is not to exorcise our demons. I told him that was simplistic.
Well, listen, you don't suppose it was a quack?
I don't know. I can never make head or tail out of those diplomas.
probably should have gone to a veterinarian.
Probably.
Did they make you fill out a form?
Yes. They told me Blue Cross wouldn't cover it.
Was there a space for your occupation?
Yes, a blank space. Two of them, in fact. One for you and one for me. In yours, I wrote procurer of our daily bread. In mine, I wrote simply scavenger.
Was there a space for children's names?
Yes. I put them in. In parentheses, I put, they used to be dependent.
Well, he noticed they were young and in care of guardians.
He asked, who cares for these children? I said, Mrs. Taylor. He asked, who is Mrs. Taylor? I said, a black Madonna.
Well, did he think you cruel, or did he think you liberated?
He tunneled then, beyond the condoms, Q-tips, cotton balls. He asked for a full description of my nursery, and I complied.
You described your nursery, and you said, in my nursery, there was at first cradle cap and then 3 months of colic, projectile vomiting and curdled diarrhea. There was prickly heat, ear infections, chronic fevers prior to crawling. There were splintered ankles, bruised foreheads, stitched lips after walking, and that was all before they even left the house. And then, being our children, they soon developed a facility with words. I contented myself for a while with answering their questions.
I told them why the grass was green. I didn't opt for God, but told them plainly, chlorophyll. And when they asked that primal, loaded question, I told them where they came from, dismissing categorically storks and birds and bees. Stamens and stigmas. Mummy seed and daddy seed. I gave them milk for calcium, fish for protein, broccoli for shiny hair. I gave them love. As much as I could siphon off. I taught them bowel control, motor control, and self-control. Having done all that, I went out and turned off the sprinkler, put the bicycles in the garage, turned on the yard lights, fed the dog, bolted the doors, and went to bed. Would you like some more wine?
Yeah, thanks. Listen, pardon my ego, but at $50 an hour, didn't I get equal time?
Oh, yes. He was concerned about you. Well, he asked about you. I can't remember his exact question.
Approximately what was it?
Approximately this. What happens to a man when his good housekeeper lies for 30 days a drumlin on the horizon of her bed? I told him. Nothing very original.
There came upon the scene a certain key punch operator named Cindy Lou. Cindy Lou had a bouncing bosom and a defect in her upper lip which made it appear puffed and swollen. For some reason, I found that very appealing. Cindy Lou was somewhat lacking in gray matter. For instance, I had to take her with me to Hartford one day on business. As we were driving through Connecticut, we passed a farm. The land was rolling and rocky. Cindy Lou seemed to be pondering something, so I said, a penny for your thoughts, Cindy Lou. She said, I wonder why they put all those big rocks in there with the cows. Well, physical chemistry being what it is, and what with her thigh only 6 inches from mine, I even managed to find that little observation appealing. We met at the Americana once a week at noon and took a room. Except for those days of the month when she was, as she said, hatching. This, however, meant that we had to forego lunch, and back at work around 3 p.m., our two stomachs growled at each other across a sea of desks. But bless her heart, she rose to the occasion. One day after we'd made love, she opened a brown paper bag and took out two sandwiches and a thermos of coffee.
You never told me that.
Didn't I? I must have.
Innocent omission, I suppose. What kind?
Instant, I think.
The sandwiches.
Ah, cream cheese.
And Welch's grape?
Smucker's plum.
Oh, well. Nevertheless, it was
Nevertheless, it was very dear to think of her standing in her little mini kitchen in her fifth floor walk-up, preparing lunch for me at 8 a.m. The thermos had but one cup. It was a loving cup. We drank from the same side, and all in all, it was very appealing. Our physical encounters were something like crash landings, and I was only slightly put off by the Corvette labels in her underwear. She was soft and giving and boldly experimental, something of a contortionist, actually.
And that disturbed me because within 2 months, we'd run the gamut. She was bored. Oh, I knew she was bored. I met it head on. I said, well, where do we go from here, Cindy Lou? And she replied,
I want a pretty house and babies. I told him you were just as mad as I. I told him how you spend the weekends at your power saw building custom homes for birds. He said it was probably very therapeutic until I told him that you construct elaborate Georgian mansions for cardinals and blue jays. I told him there was madness in your Doric and Ionic columns. He said, assumptions on the part of the patient are always spurious.
Oh, Christ.
And I told you you'd be disappointed in me. Paucity of élan in the whole proceeding.
I'm not disappointed.
Truly?
Truly. The questions he asked had to be routine. As predictable as boys and girls and marriage and babies. As inevitable as pain at 40. The choices at both ends, questions and answers, are very limited. Still, it's probably a good idea to air it all.
There was so much more I could have told him.
Yeah, somewhere in there with the laundry and the watermelon, you could have told him that I ride the Long Island Railroad and read Forbes. I mow the lawn, prune the roses, fix the faucets, mend the broken wicker chairs. I'm a property owner, a member of the much maligned bourgeoisie. I have to protect my vested interest, make my plot of earth appreciate. Spring for me is W-2 forms, rusty mowers, innumerable trips to the hardware. Summer is June, the end of the fiscal year. I frantically juggle my accounts and make my alterations, and then pray that my friendly IBM 360 will justify my monthly wage and help me keep my secrets. Fall is a time of reckoning, a time to take stock. I make new starts, which lead to half starts, which lead to dead ends, which lead to New Year's resolutions. I interrupted this cycle only once. I remember I was sitting in my cubicle on Lexington Avenue. I was plugged into a conference call. Me and a dozen other marketing men, plugged in, mass communicating. Suddenly my office door opened and J.C. came in. J.C. the omnipotent. J.C. with a gleam in his eye and a quiver in his voice. Where is she today? He asked. I said, oh, you know, stalking the gutters in Oyster Bay. Damned good pickings there, you know, in Oyster Bay. He smiled and closed the door. He went away gratified, fulfilled. And then it occurred to me. I was no longer just a cog in the organizational wheel. J.C. was getting his kicks at the expense of my beloved. I had become Rochester. She was Bertha in my attic. I was overwhelmed with resentment. I envied her bits of tangled yarn, her dead anemones. I envied her arid desert, her broad expanse of sleep. I came home and wrote a hasty suicide note. I closed off the kitchen, turned on the gas. I lay down on a braided rug in front of the stove and waited for that moment when my whole life would pass before me. I lay there on a braided rug, and only one thought hovered in my mind. I thought, it really stinks in here. Why the hell doesn't somebody open a window? Well, according to my best laid plans, nobody was around, so I had to open it myself. I succeeded only in killing the cactus plant on the windowsill. You could have told him that now I write suicide notes. I let it all hang out on the blank backs of IBM printouts. I find that I experience something very close to euphoria while writing them. Some are terse, some are poignant, some run 8 to 10 pages. It is with deep regret that I submit this resignation. My reasons for doing so are entirely personal and do not reflect upon the considerable shortcomings of those I leave behind. I have no desire to castigate my fellow procurers at the office. However, it is unfortunate that after 10 laborious years in my cubicle, seldom was heard an encouraging word. I want to meet my maker. I've endeavored to contact him on several occasions, but always, as the Hallmark cards say, across the miles. I want a direct confrontation. I want his undivided attention. I've had it up to here with conference calls. I am plagued as of late by transistor radios. Where are the ballads? Where are the lyrics? I wish to God Aretha Franklin would learn to enunciate. Back in my day, Sarah Vaughan sang Body and Soul with Plentiful Soul, and by God, Miss Vaughan knew how to enunciate. There's $248 and a gold nugget from the Klondike in the hole in the plaster over my closet door. Take it and enjoy. Nobody loves me. Everybody hates me. I'm going to the garden to eat worms.
I write them, I edit them, I file them in the library with all the other scraps of paper. I've decided that it's better to ride in tandem than not to ride at all.
And when they unload us on the platform every night, I bounce off the train in jubilation. I don't know what the hell I'm coming home to. And you should have told him. Sometimes I bring you sparkling wine and white gardenias, and there's a harvest moon, and it's not so bad.
Blood lovers.
Right.
Well, at that point, we only had about 2 minutes left.
Time's winged chariot.
Zoom, like Barney Oldfield.
How did he wrap it up?
In what terms, he said, do you presently see the world around you?
Well, that's a puzzler. I wouldn't know how to answer that in 2 minutes.
I didn't either. But I thought I'd better go out on a wave of pertinence. I said, billboards, Dixie cups, snowmobiles and Hondas, kinetic sculpture, lawn flamingos, geodesic domes. And suddenly, I was grieved. I felt a deep sense of loss. I said, Duke Ellington died recently, you know? Yes, he said, very sad, very pertinent. He said, still Bette Midler singing songs of love. Oh, yes, I said, but not for me.
Are you going to see him again?
No. Do you know what he wrote on his clean white pad at the end?
Some all-encompassing Latin word?
No, two words. Urban blight.
Oh, Christ.
And the hourglass, do you know what he said when he gave it to me?
What?
He said, here, there is real sand in this.
You gonna keep it?
Oh, yes, as a memento. I'll put it on a shelf and turn it over now and then.
And I guess you'll be going out tomorrow.
Oh, yes, I must. Get out of bed and go out.
For what?
Tomorrow? Glass, I think.
Sometimes she goes very far afield. Sometimes she puts it all away in drawers and closets. Sometimes I help her sort it through. Tomorrow she'll collect broken glass. Brown and green and amber shards from beer and ginger ale and medicines. Occasionally, there's blue from Bromo Seltzer, but that's very rare and precious. We examine these pieces for the raised initials, the stamp of the maker. This stamp appears on every bottle made in the USA.
An O with an I in it means Owens, Illinois. An anchor with an H means Anchor Hawking. An H with an A under it is Hazel Atlas. A B in a circle is Brockway. And a manuscript L is Libby.
It's a far cry from Chippendale or Sheraton or Ming, but it fills the empty spaces. And really, what harm does it do?
American Modern by Joanna M. Glass. Joanna Merlin was heard as Pat and Tom Aldridge as Mike. The play was directed by Daniel Freudenberger and engineered by Leanne Unger. After the recording, Earplay's John Madden spoke in the studio with Daniel Freudenberger.
Well, Dan, perhaps you'd begin by telling me where this play came from.
This is one of the rare instances where I get a play that I like entirely on an unsolicited basis. It came in the mail. I remember sitting down and reading it and being bowled over. I had no reaction to it. Just taking it off the printed page, I knew this was a play I had to do. I subsequently found out it had already been done in New York, you know, on a workshop basis. But that is no problem for us. We're interested in not necessarily doing the New York or American premiere of a new play, but in exposing, in a first-class production, scripts that may have had exposure in any city across the United States or in a showcase or workshop in New York, and giving them a first-class production and exposing them to critical scrutiny so that the writer becomes known to the New York press and to the New York theater audience generally.
Why does it have the title American Modern?
Well, it was conceived as the second half of a double bill, the first half being a play that is related thematically but not related in terms of shared characters, called Canadian Gothic. So the title of the evening in the theater that we performed was Canadian Gothic American Modern. In terms of the portion of her experience that Joanna Glass was writing about, Canadian Gothic is very much the atmosphere of Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, where she grew up, and American Modern is very much her experience 30 years later, living in various suburbs of various large American cities. Now, that's not to say that the young girl in Canadian Gothic is Joanna Glass any more than it's to say that Pat in American Modern is Joanna Glass 30 years later, but those were the two areas from her experience that she drew on.
I see. The relationship between the two principals, or the only two characters in the play in American Modern, is a very cordial one, is a very warm one, despite a somewhat checkered history in terms of Pat's emotional condition. How do you feel she arrives at that conclusion?
Well, the author describes her as not being a woman on the verge of madness or insanity, but rather a patient suffering from an advanced case of sanity. She sees her situation so clearly that her self-awareness becomes painful. It's not that she's incapable of dealing with the role that society has foisted on her because she's biologically a woman, but rather that she sees the way that role restricts her as a person, and the awareness of being trapped in the role, driving the kids to school and to their extracurricular activities, keeping up the appearance of a pleasant middle-class suburban home life, being a good wife to her husband who gets on a train every day to go into the city. The accumulation of these things becomes painful to her when she sees to what degree these things have made her a prisoner. And she does what for her is the only thing that she can do, which is to one morning simply refuse to get up, something I think probably all of us have wanted to do at one time or another, the difference being that she stayed in bed for a month, and she simply refused to answer the demands that the outside world made on her. And at the end of a month, her children had been placed in foster homes because she realized that she was in terrible danger of ruining their lives because she wasn't able to cope with the demands of motherhood. And her relationship with her husband had changed, because from then on, he was constantly forced to analyze every one of her acts as potentially the act of a mad woman. And when you put those two burdens alongside the burden of this compulsive collecting that she does, where she, the only things that she finds a productive activity is going around through the gutters collecting junk that other people are throwing away and then arranging this detritus into some kind of order that makes some kind of a statement. In the play, for example, we're given the example of her finding first a stone with an initial scratched on it and then a stubby pencil, and then a Parker fountain pen, and then a Bic ballpoint pen, and then seeing a neighbor called Mr. Gutenberg, by arranging those bits of junk into the sequence that corresponds with the development of the written word, she is able to express herself. It's something that society writes off as totally useless. But in her world, it's not very much different from an artist who does collages. And in the physical production on stage, the scenery was indeed six giant collages, which were quite artistically arranged by the scene designer, but arranged out of the same kind of junk that she might have picked up on the street. Indeed, we sent the apprentices out, and they brought back just cartons of junk that they had found on the ice-strewn streets of New York in November, and those were the things that we used to make the set. She's very nearly crazy in most people's terms, and yet for her she has found an equilibrium that allows her to continue, and because she can continue, her relationship with her husband is viable again, and he supports her while constantly keeping an eye on her.
Yes. It's interesting what you said that about the pain of her situation deriving, in a sense, from her awareness of it, which is the kind of people that the play is written about, is, I think, a very relevant one, because part of the problem that we have is an over-awareness of our own situations rather than just an ability to experience things directly. Do you think that both the characters in this play are very articulate people? Do you think that their articulacy makes their situation, eases their situation, or do you think it actually traps them in their situation?
Well, I think that Joanna Glass, who is that articulate, would say without hesitation that it's by talking, it's by making jokes, it's by sharing that articulateness that the characters survive and keep their sanity, such as it is. I think that a person who doesn't have that particular tool as a stratagem for coping with the enormity of the challenges that modern life throws at you might very well say that their progress toward a more normal existence is hampered by the articulateness. It's a difficult question. It's like the chicken and the egg.
Do you, it's a little bit soon afterwards to ask you, but do you feel that there's anything that you can say about the difference in terms of directing this play for the stage and then directing it for radio?
Well, I think that the salient point about Joanna Glass's writing is that she has an incredible ear for language. Her writing is clean, crisp, it's filled with images. She's not afraid to use images in prose, and she has an incredible ear for the way people speak. So that quality, the speakability of her words, was the same both on stage and on the radio production. If anything, I feel that the radio medium allows us to tune into that language without the distractions that the visual appearance of the characters has on the stage, without the set, without lighting, without, to be as blunt about it as I can, the possibility that somebody's going to come in late and sit in front of you, or someone's going to have a cold next to you. There's a lot to be said, as much of a proponent of live theater as I am, for optimum conditions, and certainly recording the play in a perfectly quiet studio where you can get every inflection just right is highly desirable, particularly to a director who can remember less than optimum conditions in the theater.
Is my experience of her, the only other work of hers that I know, which is a play called Artichoke, is that very much the same kind of thing applies, actually. That you know, the word is of absolute vital importance, and in a sense what she is concerned with is the kind of interior lives of the characters as much as their exterior communication with one another. It's certainly true of the central figure in that, the farmer's wife. reminds me very much of this particular character.
In Joanna's plays, no matter what station in life people have, they're nevertheless blessed with an uncanny ability to tell us about what they feel.
Which is useful.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was an interview with Daniel Freudenberger, recorded following the production of the play. American Modern was produced by Earplay, the Radio Drama Production Center for Public Broadcasting. Thank you.
Earplay is made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.